Alison McMann is the author of Elise Guy Blaché, Lost Visionary of the Cinema, joining us on the program this morning. Hello, Alison.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Alison, having done a little bit of reading when we're coming into this story about Elise Guy Blaché's history, how is it that somebody who is so influential within the cinema industry and the history of the industry, not recognized very much by the industry itself?
Well, it's a little bit complicated in her case, but it's true that many silent filmmakers were forgotten and their work was lost. In her case, her career, apart from being silent films, which after the advent of sound cinema, people didn't think silent films were so important, so we lost about 90% of all silent films, partly because silent films were made out of nitrate film, which had silver in it, so a lot of those films were recycled to recover the silver in World War One. In Alice's case, adding to those problems is the fact that she worked for Gaumont in the first half of her career, so many of those films still survived because Gaumont kept them, but the films she made in the American half of her career, many of them are lost, although we keep finding them here and there, even today. And finally, the fact that she was a woman had a lot to do with it as well.
Why because she was a woman? Is it because the films were chosen to be recognized as being made by men, or was it just that in general we don't tend to recognize the important role that women have had within the film industry?
I would say yes to both. Part of the problem is that no films had credits on them until about 1912, and then the first credits that were put on films were actually the names of the actors. They didn't even have a term for director. If you read the media of the time, they would say the production was supervised by Alice Guy Blaché, and that would mean she was something like an executive producer. And then if it said personally supervised by Alice Guy Blaché, that meant she directed it. So just the fact that the terminology was murky made it difficult to figure out who did what. And today, I think we place undue importance on the role of the director. So some scholars feel that if you can't prove that she directed a film, then you shouldn't be able to say that she made it at all. But she actually produced and supervised the production of more than 1,000 films, and she directed at least 700 of them, perhaps more.
That's phenomenal. There would be so many directors and producers that would be sitting there thinking, how could someone produce and direct so many films?
It wasn't easy. Remember that most of these films were one-reelers, so they were 15 minutes or less. 150 of them were synchronized sound films, which she made between 1905 and 1906. That's a good 20 years before the jazz singer and synchronized sound as we know it. But she was making films for the Gaumont chronophone system. So she started out, for the first 12 years of her career, she was the only woman directing films as a career that we know about. There weren't any others until Lois Weber started in the States in 1908, and Lois Weber got her start because Alice Guy Blaché and her husband Herbert Blaché hired her to do some acting at their company.
We need to understand.
So she started her career. Go ahead.
We need to understand, firstly, that this is pre-Hollywood. So what was the film industry like then? Because she was the co-founder of Solex Studios. Was that an important studio at the time?
It was. The first half of her career was working for Gaumont in France, 1894 to 1907. She started out as a secretary when Gaumont invented a moving picture camera a little bit after the Lumières invented theirs. She started making films to help sell the camera, and then she began making films for their own commercial sake. By 1910, Fort Lee, New Jersey had become an important film center in the United States. It was Hollywood before Hollywood, and Alice had moved to New York because her new husband Herbert was creating a Gaumont English language chronophone franchise in Flushing, New York. And then she decided to start her own film studio First, she rented out the Gaumont Conifon studio, and then she built her own studio in Fort Lee, New Jersey. The studio was described as costing over $100,000, which at the time was major. She was the first woman to own her own film studio, lock, stock, and barrel, and run it.
When you go back and take a look, and this is what I found really interesting when you take a look at her life, is that early when she started looking at film, it was really only, film was only made to document things for news or to scientific things. It was to document things. She was one of the early people or one of the first people to say, let's make stories out of it. Let's make fictional stories.
Yes, that's correct. She was at the March 22nd, 1895 Lumiere screening where they showed workers leaving the factory, which was basically a commercial for their shoe factory. And she also was present when Georges Demenis first displayed a technology he had called the phonoscope to display moving images. His would only display 24 frames, but that was probably the first time she ever saw images move. Soon after the Lumiere screening, she turned to her boss, Gaumont, and said, I think we could do more with this. Her father had been a publisher, and her mother had helped him edit the book, so she'd grown up in a house filled with fiction stories, and she said, I'm the daughter of an editor. I could make stories for this new industry, although they didn't know it was going to become an industry, and he gave her permission as long as it didn't interfere with her secretarial work.
I love that in itself. But it, as far as film is concerned, that's incredibly significant. And that was one of the reasons that I found it interesting that she's not recognized as much as she should be, because that move from documenting things in fact through to the creation and the start of a fiction film industry is a really important step.
It's a very important step. She didn't make the first fiction film, however. The Lumières made a film called where this gardener finds a little boy is teasing him by stepping on the hose. The gardener gets a face full of water. Then he catches the boy and gives him a whipping. And that film was made before Alice made her first film. But Alice made it the central work of her artistic career to develop cinematic narrative. And she invented and pioneered many, if not all, of the cinematic techniques that were later credited to people like D.W. Griffith.
Can you tell us what sort of techniques you're talking about?
Well, for example, parallel cutting, the use of a point of view shot where you're looking at something from a character's perspective. Even just the idea that a cinematic story should be centered around one character's psychological perspective. Before Alice started doing this, she had perfected it around 1906. You just had huge crowd scenes sometimes on the screen moving along, and you really couldn't follow the story unless you already knew it, which is why many films between 1896 and 1905 or so were based on stories people already knew, like Cinderella or The Life of Christ.
If you'd like to join us in this conversation, by the way, 1-300-800-222. Not only about the life of Alice Guy Blaché, but also if you want to talk about the early film industry around the silent films and before and then moving into the talkies. 1-300-800-222. Text us on 0437-774-774. And as I'm talking to Alison, if you have any questions that you would like to ask about Alice Guy Blaché's life, 1-300-800-222 is the number to call.
Be entertained with Evenings.
This is the most exciting thing that's happened to us in quite some time.
Enjoying a glass of red while my dinner warms up.
It was just wonderful. Yeah, what a great show.
It can't be underestimated. It either shouldn't be underestimated or can't be overestimated.
I went to a Catholic school and I'm pretty sure that when Elvis died, they announced it over the PA and then asked us to pray for Elvis.
Weeknights on ABC Radio and the ABC Listen app.
1-300-800-222, text 0437-774-774. As we take a look at the life this morning of Alice Guy Blaché, if you've got any questions to ask or comments you'd like to make as I have a chat with Alison this morning, give us a ring and join the conversation. At this time, Alison, was there an audience for the film that she was making?
Are you talking about her Solex films or the earlier Gaumont films?
The earlier Gaumont films, but I guess leading into the Solex films later.
Okay, so originally she made films. Their purpose was sort of like software that gets bundled with your laptop when you buy a new laptop. She made films as demonstrations to show what the cameras could do. They weren't sold separately. Gradually, Gaumont began to realize that they could be a moneymaker, and it became more and more her job to make these films. And finally, around 1903, 1904, Gaumont even had his own screening room, and people would go and watch the movies, and the films were also distributed to other exhibitors around Europe. And by 1906, they were distributed in the States. When she started making films for Solex, they went into wide distribution all over Europe and the States.
So this is at a time where it was more of a novelty and was possibly looked at more as an art form necessarily than what we know as cinema.
Well, it depends when in your career you're talking about. When she made the synchronized sound cells for the Gaumont Chronophone, those were definitely a novelty. People were amazed to see the movies talk. There had been experiments before, but they were never really well synchronized, and they weren't well amplified, but the Gaumont Chronophone solved a lot of those problems, and so you really felt, we have records of people who saw these films, you really felt like you were watching somebody speaking, and some people even got up and walked behind the screen to see if there were actors there voicing the part. Mostly the audiences were women and children, and you can kind of see this, that she made stories that often focused on female characters. Even her version of The Life of Christ has a lot of episodes that focus on women, because she knew that women would go shopping and then they might slip into Nickelodeon or whatever they were called in France and spend half an hour there looking at movies before they went back to their shopping or went home.
When you take a look at that and who she was making film for, is that because at that time she was wanting to put forward what was happening in women's lives, or was it just that that happened to be what she was making? What was the purpose or reason behind that?
When she made films for the Gaumont Company, she didn't have that much control over what got made, what the stories were. Although she did hire Louis Feuillade as a writer in 1905, and then he would write screenplays that she would assign to him. But she often did things like stole plots from popular operas or popular musicals and then made live-action films based on the same stories, again, because they were things that were already popular and people would watch. Once she went to Solex, she had complete control over every aspect of every film she made, even if she didn't direct it herself. And then what we would consider to be, you know, the films that she wanted to make, and that's when we saw girls who cuddled up to tigers and girls who rode on elephants or escaped from an abusive parent by tying together sheets and climbing out the window dressed as a man, girls who shot flaming arrows, who galloped away on horses to get the bad guy, who rescued their father who'd fallen over a cliff by hauling him up with a lasso, all sorts of things, incredible movies that are still very engaging to audiences today.
If you'd like to join us, 1-300-800-222 on text 0437 774 774 as we take a look at early film and really at the life of Elise Guy Blanchet, who was one of the, well, she was at the forefront of the American film industry. 1-300-800-222 on text 0437 774 774. My guest this morning is Alison McMann, who is the author of Lost Visionary of the Cinema, Elise Guy Blanchet. If you've got any questions to ask or comments to make about what she was doing in the film industry, how she went about doing it, any questions about her life, 1-300-800-222, text us 0437 774 774.
Do you know a young person who has a story to tell? Haywire wants to know what it's like growing up in regional Australia.
I want to try and make a difference in the world. I want everyone to be able to seek justice and be heard.
Winners get their story featured on the ABC and win an all-expenses-paid trip to the Haywire Regional Youth Summit in Canberra.
The idea came to me while I stood in the middle of a paddock.
Entries are open now and close September 16. Go to abc.net.au/haywire.
1-300-800-222 is the number to call. Alison McMann is my guest this morning as we're taking a look at the life of Elise Guy Blaché and her role within the US film industry, and possibly how it is that she isn't recognised as much as many other people are through the film industry. Alison, we were talking about, you just before, we were talking about the advent of talking and talkies. She must have had a huge amount of knowledge of the engineering side of the industry as well, or did she work with people?
She knew a little bit about everything because she'd started out as a secretary for Beaumont. As his business changed and evolved more, he started out as with a shop that sold still photography products to aristocrats, scientists, medical people, explorers, the aristocracy. And as his business diversified and developed, she was at the front row for that. She also probably did some work retouching photographs, so she was familiar with that process, and she oversaw. They didn't edit silent films in the beginning. Things were all one shot, but then as they started to edit things together, she would have to supervise that as well as how they were colorized, because the early films were colored by hand. She had a lot to do with, not that she worked on the device, but she also put together the catalogs that promoted Beaumont's work, which included all the synchronized sound films, and she was the main person who directed the films for that system. The way they directed those is first they would have a singer from the opera, the Café Concert, who would be in the Beaumont studio in Paris and sing their number onto a wax, which would be recorded onto a wax cylinder. So the maximum length was 4 minutes because that's how long the wax cylinder was. And then Alice would film them performing in sync with their own recording. And she would have to direct them very carefully. These were people who were used to performing on stage, making every performance different. And then she would have to coach them to match their own recording precisely.
If you'd like to join us, 1-300-800-222. Rob has. Good morning, Rob.
Yeah, good morning. Gee, this is really interesting. She sounds like an incredible woman.
Hmm.
Just one question I ask. Was the first movie ever made was the Melvin Cup?
You see, this is when they were doing very, very early, when they were doing newsreels, which is when you take a look at the history of film, Alison, there was an awful lot of newsreels being done.
Yes, I'm not sure that I or any film scholar could point.
Oh, I think we've just lost the phone line.
Excuse me?
Oh, there we are. We got you. So you were just saying...
It's hard to say which was the very first film ever made in the world, but we know who the first filmmakers were. The Lumiere brothers were among the earliest. Edison had some people in his lab making films for his kinetoscope. Very early on, there were a pair of German brothers in Germany. There were people in England. There were people all over the world who were experimenting with things. But most of them were recording things that were in front of them just the way they had when they were taking photographs. They didn't think to make story films out of it until the Lumières made the water, L'Arrosée, Arrosée, and Alice went on to make that her life's work, making story films.
When you take a look at her life as a filmmaker, how did her films change and develop over her career?
Well, they changed with changes in the industry. Like I said, she started making these one-minute films where everything had to happen in one shot. And then she had two-shot films, and then the films got a little longer. By 1904-05, she was making films that were 10 minutes long that were edited. And her biggest contribution to the cinematic art was right around this time when she started focusing the story in the film around the psychological journey of a single character. So, for example, she has a movie about an evil stepmother, and the whole film follows this little boy. He has this evil stepmother, and the stepmother tortures him whenever the dad isn't looking, and the boy runs away, and he's picked up by the police, and the police see that he's covered with bruises, and then they reveal this to the father, and the father gets rid of the stepmother, and he sticks to the boy. But you only see what happens from the boy's perspective. That was really unusual. Other people say that Georges Méliès is the father of fiction cinema, but he did not make films like that. He did not have that concept of following, like a novel, a single character's emotional and psychological journey. But Alice Guy did that.
When you take a look at that storyline, was it her writing, was it her wanting to develop those sorts of storylines, those types of characters, and then put them into film? Was she involved in not only the filming, but also the screenwriting and everything involved in those films?
Until...
We might see, we'll see if we can get that phone line just a little bit clearer because it's jumping in and out. We'll see if we can work out what's going on with that. Gordon's got a question up there. Where can we see her films? Which is a really interesting point, Gordon, because when I was doing the research and having a look at this, you hear about the development, especially of the narratives and how it is that they look in cinema and actually how they develop is an interesting thing within itself. Now, we were just fine. Sorry about that, Alison. We were just fine. You were just telling us about the development of those narratives and if she was the person that not only wrote them but filmed them.
Yes, she wrote, directed, and produced and found the costumes and scattered the location because Gaumont didn't have a studio until 1905, so she had to shoot on real locations, which was unusual at the time. She did all of that herself. By 1905, she had to make so many films that she couldn't do it alone, so she hired Louis Feuillade, Etienne Arnaud, Romeo Bozzetti. If you know anything about French cinema, you recognize these names, and you know that she ended up training the next generation of French filmmakers.
And does that training of filmmakers then move on into the American film industry as well, especially because Solex was so pivotal as being pre-Hollywood? How important was Solex into the advent and to the movement into Hollywood?
Solex was an independent film company, which means that it didn't have the blessing of the Motion Picture Patents Corporation, which was run by Edison. He was trying to create a monopoly over all film distribution. So Solex had to operate, you know, by the seat of their pants, basically. But she did train many filmmakers. Wilbert Melville learned studio management techniques from Alice Guy Blaché, and he went on to apply those to Lubin, which ended up becoming part of Hollywood. She and Alice and her husband, Herbert Blaché, made films for Metro, which eventually became part of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. She made stars out of many of her actors, and she trained designers, like Henri Menessier was a designer who worked for her in Paris, and he also worked for Solex, and he wanted a shot at writing, and she had him write a screenplay for her, which became The Sewer, a marvelous film, which we still have today, an early noir crime film.
I've got a text here from Gordon who says, "Hi, where can we see her films? Also, if her father was a publisher, did writing influence her style or development of the narratives within itself?"
Writing absolutely influenced her style. Later, after her career ended, she made a living writing stories for magazines, and she often took the stories she'd written for her films and rewrote them as magazine stories under pen names. But it was part of the fact that her father was a publisher and an editor for a publishing house, for his own publishing house, is what gave her the idea to make story films to begin with. And to see her films, if you Google Alice Guy Blaché, quite a few films come up on YouTube. The Gaumont has a DVD box set of the films that they have, all in one box set, which is sold both with the European Signal and the American Signal. And some DVD box sets have been released or will be soon be released by Kino Lorber in the U.S.
1-300-800-222. Text 0437-774-774 if you want to join us as we take a look at the life of Elise Guy Blanchet. Alison, if she was so pivotal to the industry, why was it that when we start to see the advent of Hollywood, why is it she doesn't continue in the industry?
Well, by 1918, she was born in 1873, so by 1918-1920, she was older. She almost died of the Spanish influenza in late 1919, and her marriage, which was also, she was business partners with her husband, her marriage was on the rocks, and her husband went to Hollywood to continue a directing career on his own. After Alice almost died of the Spanish influenza, he invited her to come to Hollywood with him, and she assisted directed on three films that he directed with Alla Nazimova in them, and she became great friends with Alla Nazimova. But she really didn't feel like Hollywood was the place for her. Meanwhile, all of her assets were invested in the Solex studio, and she had rented it out to another film company, and a fire started, so most of the studio burnt to the ground. This was also 1919. 1919 was just a terrible year for her. And finally, she decided she'd had enough, and she got a divorce, filed for bankruptcy, packed up her children, and went back to France. She thought she would be able to restart her film career there, but France was recovering from a terrible war. It was very difficult. Gaumont was open to hiring her again, but they couldn't find the right job for her. And in the end, she went to writing magazine stories, as I said, and giving talks about her career in filmmaking, and her children became her sole source of support.
So Herbert Blanchet then moving into Hollywood, did he sort of get that entrance into Hollywood off the back of her work?
He worked for Gaumont in New York until 1913, and then he was either fired or urged to politely to resign. So he resigned, and Alice made him president of Solex. Her idea was that he would help find distribution for their films, because remember, Solex wasn't a member of the Motion Picture Patents Company Consortium, so without that, you couldn't get access to licensed distribution for your films, which made getting money for your films very hard. You had to sell them state by state. And she wanted Herbert to do that, to do all the selling, but Herbert wanted to be a director like his famous wife, so that became a source of conflict. Then he kept starting new companies so that he could get more investment funds to make more movies, and he did direct some films. He directed the first feature film that Buster Keaton starred in, the first feature-length film, which was called The Saphead. That made Buster Keaton into a star. But Herbert didn't transition into the sound era. He stopped directing films in the mid to late 20s.
When you take a look at her life when she goes back to France, does she feel like, I'm not sure if you managed to find this out through the research, but did she feel like she was missing out on the industry and that the industry was moving away from her, but she had a pivotal role in the establishment of it?
Yes, she definitely felt that way. The first job she tried to get was to oversee the Gaumont Production Studios in Nice, and she put together a whole proposal with costs and changes that would be needed to the studio, and Gaumont felt that her proposal was too costly. Like I said, they were in between the wars. Financially, it was a very difficult time, and the Nice studio ended up not getting redeveloped until much later.
When you take a look at her life as it goes into the end of her career, but also as she gets older, was she still recognised as being a great film member, and was she recognised for the role that she's played in the beginning of the film industry in itself?
She was a darling of the press when she was actually working in New Jersey. The American press always loved her. They loved this idea of a woman running her own film company, but she wasn't a racy woman. She was happily married, and her husband worked in the same industry, and she owned her own studio, and she had her children act in her films, and the press just loved that, this combination of professional and wife and mother and proper family woman. In France, she hadn't gotten any credit for her films. This was something later in her old age. She started a deferential writing campaign with Léon Gaumont, and after Léon Gaumont died, with his son Louis Gaumont, trying to correct the record, because by then the first history books about the development of cinema were being written, and she was being left out of them. She had no way to prove what films she made. The films themselves couldn't be found or didn't exist, and Gaumont had never really given her credit for what she did. Just for the record, he didn't want to give Louis Feuillade much credit either, but Feuillade's films had his name on it, so it was easier for Feuillade than it was for Alice.
If that's the case, how difficult was it to research the book about her? The documentary has just been made about her life as well. How difficult was it to research?
If you're referring to Pamela Green's film, Be Natural, that documentary was based in part on my research. But I did most of my research. I started in 1992, and then my book came out in 2002. So mostly I did it before the internet was really a good research resource. Now we have so many newspapers and things that have been digitized, so I still keep a website and a blog because I find new things all the time. People send me things, and I try to update my findings. But when I did it, it was really difficult. I had to physically go to Europe and crisscross Europe in trains and go to the different archives to look at films and see if I could identify it as an Alice Guy film or not. In the mid-90s, because it was a centenary of cinema, there were funds for restoring films. So the fact, if I would identify a film as being a work of the first woman filmmaker, usually money was found to save it.
When I had a look at the short for the documentary that's just been made, and one in the beginning of it, in that short, they ask people within the film industry, directors and producers, if they've ever heard of her. And a lot of them have never heard of her, but then are amazed when you take a look at her story. Is that one of the important things now, that there is, you've written a book about her, there's a documentary being made about her, that she is finally getting the recognition that she deserves?
I think it's very important. I think there are many silent filmmakers that deserve to be part of the history books, but she's especially important because her career happened so early on in the development of cinema. We learned so much. This is why I started my research to begin with. I went to NYU Film School. The oldest film they showed us were maybe a couple Charlie Chaplin films from 1914. It was as if the 20 years of cinema that happened before that had never happened. But most filmmakers today don't find it really useful to study silent cinema. It's, why should they care exactly? Unless you're someone like me and you want to learn from what they did to maybe make a new film, do something different by looking back to the past. That was my goal when I started my research.
How was it that you first heard her name?
I was very lucky. I was working on a film, working on a documentary in Manhattan in 1985, and my camerawoman and I took a lunch break, and my camerawoman opened the newspaper and said, the Museum of Modern Art is having a retrospective of the films by the first woman filmmaker tonight. And I said, who's the first woman filmmaker? Because neither of us knew. We had learned how to, you know, run a camera and run a sound recorder and run a Steam Deck editing machine, but we didn't really know anything about film history. So we went to the screen that night, which was curated by Cecile Starr, and I saw seven films by Alice Guy, and there was no piano player, there was no sound, and I was just watching these films in absolute silence and thinking, I love the way these films look, but I really have no idea what's going on. And I realized it was going to be a job, that I was going to have to learn how to read the films. But that's what I did. I ended up getting a PhD in cinema studies, learning how to read the films and trying to make them accessible to people who were as confused as I was that day.
It's an amazing story, and to find out that somebody had such influence on the film industry in general, not only with the making of film and the development of the film in itself, but also how the narrative is told, is such an important part of film history that we know about. I've got a text here that says, hi Trev and Alison, an amazing lady and fascinating story. Is there a museum or collection of her work in Paris?
You know, this is a sore point with me. The Cinémathèque Française used to have a room that had a couple of plaques about her with an image of her directing Son of Sen, which was what the Gaumont synchronized sound films were called. And then when they moved to their new location, they took all of that out. So they have some exhibits related to Gaumont, but from what I hear, they don't have anything about Alice. So the answer to that is no. If you go to Fort Lee, New Jersey, however, they have plaques all over the town, like where the Solex studio was and different places that were important in her film career. They also show her films, and they really work hard to preserve that part of her film history.
Look, it's been fascinating talking to you about it, Alison. It's a story in history and especially in film that many of us should know more about. If people are interested in finding out more, Alison's book you can find as well. And also there's a documentary coming out very, very soon. Alison's book is called Elise Guy Blechet, Lost Visionary of the Cinema. Alison, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Alison McMahon, the author of Elise Guy Blechet, Lost Visionary of the Cinema. And the documentary about her is coming out shortly with Jodie Foster doing the narration for it. This is Overnights on ABC Radio.